Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group is hosting a panel debate or discussion on the President's authority to engage in Libya. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. I'm Ron Cass. I'm Dean Emeritus of Boston University's School of Law, President of Cass and Associates, and a former member of the U.S. International Trade Commission. I'm pleased to welcome our podcasters for this event on the Libyan engagement, David Rivkin of Baker and Hostetler, Professor Sai Krishna Prakash of the University of Virginia School of Law, Professor Peter Spiro of Temple University's Beasley School of Law, and Edwin Williamson of Sullivan and Cromwell. I'm going to give a brief introduction to each before they begin speaking. We'll have an opening round of statements, about 5 to 7 minutes. After that, we'll have time for rebuttal and discussion among the speakers. Let me begin first with David Rivkin. David is a partner at Baker and Hostetler LLP. He's a former official in a variety of positions in the federal government, having served in the White House, the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Energy, and counsel, the U.S. Council on Competitiveness. He's also a frequent commentator, writer, and speaker on national security and constitutional law matters. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And David, we'll begin with you.
Thank you very much, Ron. The President is clearly using force in Libya, whatever its policy merits. We're only talking about the law in a constitutional manner, because he does not require a declaration of war or any other form of congressional authorization. This conclusion is based upon the constitutional text, the practice that has evolved since the ratification of a constitution in the last 200-plus years, and a very sparse, and I emphasize the word sparse, judicial precedent. First, the constitutional text. The Constitution clearly does not require a president to obtain congressional authorization prior to using force. The critics of its proposition make much of a language that gives Congress the power to declare war. Unfortunately for them, they're looking at this language, a classical problem of interpreting 18th century language through the prism of the 20th or 21st century instead of looking at its original meaning. In 18th century parlance, declaration of war was primarily, and I emphasize the word primarily, about a change in legal relationships, both at home in terms of the power of the state vis-a-vis the citizenry, but even more importantly, overseas in the international law arena, power of belligerents vis-a-vis the neutrals, ability to intern the citizens of enemy states, and ability to seize their property. Britain, for example, and of course there's the British example and practice that were most instrumental in shaping the view of the framers and most illuminating in clarifying the meaning of such terms. Britain, of course, has conducted numerous wars without declarations of war. Now, I don't mean to suggest that the declaration of war was only about legal relationships. That's why I said primarily. It was also important to underscore that it was a continuum. The closer you got to a major war with a major power with decisive aims, that it was expected to be protracted, and very importantly, the closer you got to the offensive war, which of course was not banned as a matter of international law in those days, a war designed to obtain territory or effect a decisive change in the composition of ruling government of another state, the more you needed the declaration of war. That is the true meaning of a declaration of war language in the Constitution. Now, a couple of related points. There were efforts, of course, during the Constitutional Convention to limit the president's power to wage war. That is not surprising, because the framers did not agree on all or even most issues. But there are people undoubtedly who tried to cabin the president's ability to wage war, but they failed. That was reflected in a number of ways. The change from the word wage war to the term declare war. And by the way, I emphasize here that the framers certainly knew how to write language that would have decisively cabined the president's ability to wage war. All we needed to do is to look at the language of Articles of Confederation. Article 6 very clearly, exhaustively, I would say, decisively limited ability of individual states to wage war. And even when you come to the constitutional text of a more perfect union, if you look at the language that cabins the ability of states to wage war, except in the circumstances that were attacked, they clearly knew how to do it. Now, we all understand, of course, Madison's reference to the president's power to repel sudden attacks. Again, it is that language that leads the proponents of a contrary view to suggest that really the only reason we switch from the word wage to declare was the power to repel sudden attacks. That is not a correct interpretation, and that is demonstrated by a number of other points. We have a very good discussion by Hamilton in the 74 Federalist that squarely places the president's power to wage war as an integral part of the key executive power, the need for speed dispatch, et cetera, et cetera. We actually have an interesting exchange where Madison is affirming a more Madison's exchange with Patrick Henry during the 1788 ratification debates in Virginia, where Madison actually is saying very clearly and somewhat inconsistent with his earlier position that the president has the same power when it comes to holding the sword and wielding the sword as the British king. And a final point about the original meaning here is, if you consider the overarching scheme where the Congress was supposed to exercise the negative, the checking power on the president, not an affirmative power, the notion that Congress, instead of using its power of a purse to stop the president from using force, the Congress was required to give some kind of affirmative authorization, is completely inconsistent with that scheme. Very briefly, the practice here, and the practice is very important, and by the way, contrary to what has been alleged, the practice has been consistent throughout. We, of course, only had 5 times the war was declared. Over 100 times Congress used in other form of authorization, not in the form of declaration, and numerous instances where the president used force in his sole authority. And by the way, again, that was done in both offensive and defensive mode, because I would submit to you the notion, for example, that the use of force to deal with the Barbary pirates was somehow a defensive, broadly speaking, a defensive use of force, but certainly well beyond the power to repel sudden attacks. And then, of course, we have Korea, we have Libya 1 in the form of a President Reagan's bombing attack on Gaddafi, Balkan operations in the Clinton, and dozens of other examples ranging from Indian wars to intervention in Russian civil war when dispatch force, expeditionary force to Murmansk, numerous Latin American interventions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as far as judiciary is concerned, there's only one case that deals with it a bit, and that's the Price cases. There's language there that talks about the president can neither declare nor initiate war. Much hay is made out of the word initiate, but again, consistent with the 18th century practice. As I mentioned earlier, declaration of war was required not only to change those legal relationship domestically and overseas, but to wage offensive war. So the bottom line is, and that's what the court was talking about, the bottom line is the president can use force on his own authority in any instance of defensive war, much beyond ability to repel sudden attacks. To extend, the president claims that the use of force in Libya now is defensive because instability in the region or instability in Libya threatens our security. It is a political question. He is accountable to the electorate if that claim is implausible. It is not justiciable. And the only way in Congress can deal with it is to cut off the funds. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Next, we're going to hear from Sai Krishna Prakash. Sai is the David Lurton Massey Jr. Professor of Law and the Sullivan and Cromwell Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. He's a former faculty member at the University of San Diego, the University of Illinois, Northwestern University, and Boston University. Cy's scholarship focuses especially on issues of presidential power. Cy?
Thank you, Ron, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to what will be a robust and interesting conversation. I think there are three central issues regarding whether President Obama had constitutional authority to wage war against Libya. First, what authority does Congress have by virtue of the original understanding of the Constitution over waging war under its power to declare war? Second, what authority does the President have by virtue of the original understanding of the Constitution over waging war as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy? And third, has practice altered our Constitution such that the President may take the nation to war unilaterally, even if he didn't have such power at the founding? I'll speak principally about the first two questions and then just briefly touch upon the third. So what authority does Congress have over waging war under its power to declare war? In the 18th century, the power to declare war was not merely the power to issue formal declarations of the sort that denounced the enemy, declared war using those terms, and ordered the use of military force. Instead, the power to declare war included the power to decide whether to wage war. Any decision to wage war was understood as a declaration of war. So obviously a formal declaration of war was an exercise of the power to declare war, but many other words or actions were exercises of that power as well. As legal historian Stephen Neff, author of War and the Law of Nations, writes, in the late 17th and 18th century practice, quote, it came to be accepted that any unambiguous sign or signal of an intention to resort to war could function as a declaration of war, unquote. And he is quite right. So if we look to the words of the first British Prime Minister, Sir Robert Walpole, in a speech he made to the House of Commons, he says in 1738, quote, of late most wars have been declared from the mouths of cannons before any formal declaration of war. And this understanding existed well into the 19th century. So if we look at the War of Independence, when the French notified the English of their treaty of alliance with America, the English, including George III, described this as a French declaration of war against England. This understanding existed in America as well. When Sam Adams wondered to his cousin John Adams about when France would formally declare war against England, John Adams replied, quote, has not war been sufficiently declared by actual hostilities in most parts of the world? I suspect there will never be any other declaration of war, unquote. So when Congress has the power to declare war, it may decide whether to wage it. That is why James Wilson famously said that it is not within the power of one man, namely the president, to get us into war. And similarly, Pierce Butler of South Carolina said that the convention did not give the president the power to declare war because it did not wish to give him, quote, the influence of a monarch having an opportunity of involving his country in a war, unquote. So this brings us to the second question. What power does the president have as commander-in-chief over the decision to wage it? This question has two parts. One is, what are the implications of a congressional power for presidential power? And two, what are we to make of the president's authority as commander-in-chief? And when we look at the president's the potential for concurrent power, we see that many notables in the early part of our history denied that the president had the authority to declare or wage war. Among those notables, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Henry Knox, the first Secretary of War, John Adams, James Wilson, and the list goes on. Alexander Hamilton, no shrinking violet when it came to executive power, said, quote, it belongs to Congress only to go to war, unquote. Similarly, James Kent of Columbia said, quote, war can only be commenced by an act or resolution of Congress, unquote. If all this is true, what are we to make of the commander-in-chief authority? Doesn't that somehow imply the president can make war without going to Congress first? Nothing could be further from the truth. The commander-in-chief was a well-known office because both the British and Americans had them prior to the Constitution. The commander-in-chief was nothing more than a military commander of a particular unit. Each unit of the army had a military commander-in-chief, and so if you look at English practice, they had commanders-in-chiefs of platoons, brigades, various armies in Her Majesty's armies. So you have a commander-in-chief of North America, commander-in-chief of India, etc. And then during our Revolutionary War, we had the same sort of practice. We had a commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, but we also had a commander-in-chief of the Navy, and we also had sub-commanders-in-chief. None of these folks were thought to have the right or the authority to decide to wage war against other countries by virtue of that office. And so when Hamilton said in the Federalist that the commander-in-chief is but the first admiral and general in the military, he was quite right. It's command of the military. It's not authority to decide to wage war. As I stated at the outset, for 150 years, no one believed that anyone other than the Congress could decide to go to war, and no one imagined that the president could take the nation to war. David mentioned in his previous comments about various uses of force, and I think David's quite right that many of those uses of force that the Congressional Research Service has listed in its document listing 200 uses of military force were actually authorized by Congress. People tend not to regard those authorizations as declarations of war, but they in fact were once we have the proper conception of what a declaration of war was. Right? Once again, you did not need to use the words declare war in order to declare war, because actions could constitute declarations of war, and words could constitute declarations of war even if they didn't use those terms. So this takes us to the third question. Has the president acquired a constitutional power to wage war without a congressional declaration of war via practice? And before answering this question, I suppose it's worth highlighting its premise. In order to believe that this question is a useful one to ask, you have to believe in a living constitution that allows the meaning of the Constitution to change over time. I suspect that many of our listeners will have a problem with this. But if you can overcome that hurdle and if you can suppose that the Constitution's meaning can change over time, I want to suggest that there's little reason to believe that the president has acquired via practice the authority to declare or wage war. Justice Frankfurter in Youngstown spoke of a, quote, systematic, unbroken executive practice long pursued to the knowledge of Congress and never before questioned practice as perhaps creating a gloss on the executive power. And when I think you look at practice since the Korean War, what I think you see is a hodgepodge of practices. Sometimes the president has received authority from Congress via an informal declaration of war, and sometimes he hasn't. Moreover, I think it's quite clear that members of Congress throughout this period have complained that the president has usurped authority that's not properly his under the Constitution. And they haven't been alone, because commentators and academics have said much the same. So if we're going to use Frankfurter's template for deciding whether the meaning of the Constitution should change or whether there should be a gloss put on the executive power or other powers of the president, I don't think his test is met. Thank you.
Thank you, Cy. Our next speaker is going to be Professor Peter Spiro. Peter is the Charles R. Weiner Professor of Law at Temple Law School. He is a former International Affairs Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former visiting professor at the University of Texas. Peter's scholarship addresses issues in international and constitutional law across a broad range of different matters. Peter?
Thanks, Ron, and thanks to the Federalist Society for organizing today's debate. I'll take off where Cy left off and focus on practice as the key determinant of today's Constitution. So unlike Cy, I guess I believe in evolution of constitutional standards with respect to separation of powers, especially in the context of foreign relations, national security, and the war power. And if one takes the practice, and especially the recent practice, I think it's clear that President Obama enjoys authority without advance congressional authorization to undertake the military action in Libya. So why do I think that it's well within his authority under recent practice? Well, contrary to Cy, I don't think that recent practice is a hodgepodge. I think that we have the evolution of very clear norms with respect to particular kinds of use of force on unilateral presidential authority. So if we take such episodes as Grenada during the Reagan administration, Panama during the Bush administration, Somalia during the Clinton administration, it becomes clear that certain types of uses of force by presidents do not require advanced presidential authority. So here we have practice from both Republican and Democratic administrations, and a basic acceptance of a norm by all relevant constitutional actors. So in these cases, Grenada, Panama, Somalia, Lebanon, the bombing of Tripoli, Haiti, the bombing in Sudan by the Clinton administration, we have uses of force by presidents without advanced congressional authorization. These uses of force always provoke some carping, what I would call sort of constitutional carping, by isolated voices, both from Congress, the press, and of course the academy. But in the end, all of these uses of force on presidential authority have been accepted. And perhaps the episode that's most on point here is the 1999 bombing of Kosovo. So there we had an action from the air involving no troops on the ground by President Clinton with authorization of an international body, in that case NATO, and with no advanced congressional authorization. In fact, it was a failure to adopt a resolution in support of the action. So it was voted down on a tie vote in Congress. So Congress tried. There were attempts to secure congressional authorization, which failed. But President Clinton persisted in the action, and in the end, it was accepted as constitutionally legitimate. And so the parallels between Kosovo and Libya, I think, are quite strong, especially in the type of operation involved. And here, critically, the fact that there is very little risk in either operation of a significant casualties. Now, when Tsai refers to a hodgepodge of practice, I assume what he's referring to is the fact that with respect to both of the Persian Gulf conflicts, President Bush the Elder and the Younger did secure advanced congressional authorization. Those cases are easily distinguished from Libya in terms of the magnitude of the operation. And it is clear from practice that when we're looking at a major military operation that does involve significant risk of casualties and protracted conflict, that presidents do have to go to Congress to secure advanced congressional authorization. So through this recent practice, we have clear lines drawn as to when presidents are required to secure advanced congressional authorization and when such authorization is not required. So that's the practice. What's interesting about the Libya operation, and I think maybe we could take a look at some scenarios going forward, is the significance of international authorization for the operation. And here I think we've got an evolving practice under which presidents can use international authorization as the basis of constitutional authority. This is an evolving practice that, in fact, has its genesis in an action of a Republican president. So in 1992, we had Tim Flanagan at the Office of Legal Counsel, I assume a member in good standing of the Federalist Society, penning a memorandum which highlighted the fact of international authorization with respect to the president's authority to deploy U.S. forces in Somalia. That is clearly a factor in the Libya operation, and I think going forward, that by itself will suffice to establish presidential authority to undertake unilateral uses of force. If the evolution here is away from having also to establish authority on the basis of protecting U.S. citizens and U.S. property in the context of the military operation that's contemplated. So I think that going forward, the Libya more clearly establishes that on top of the Kosovo operation. It also introduces the possibility of humanitarianism as a motivation recognized in this constitutional practice for presidential uses of force. Perhaps during our conversation, we can consider some scenarios going forward in terms of what Congress's posture is towards the continuing action in Libya. Kosovo also, I think, puts the final nail in the coffin of the War Powers Resolution. So even if we come to day 61 of the Libya operation and we have no authorization from Congress, it seems clear to me that the operation can continue notwithstanding the absence of specific authorization from Congress. A question on the table would be if Congress sought affirmatively to limit the operation, whether the president would have to respect that limitation. And in my view, he would, although I think there might be some argument about that.
Thank you very much, Peter. Our final speaker for the first round of opening remarks will be Edwin Williamson. Ed is a senior counsel at Sullivan & Cromwell. He's the former U.S. legal advisor at the Department of State. He serves on the United States Executive Council for International Business and is the former chair of the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group. Ed?
Thank you, Ron, and it's a real pleasure to be with David, Ty, and Peter. I think I'll just do a quick summary I think Sy is right, but for the wrong reasons. David is wrong, but for the right reasons, and Peter is wrong for the wrong reasons. Let me do a little elaborating on that. Let me start with David. I basically agree with David's view of strong executive powers. My reservation is that I think the president's ability to invoke his commander-in-chief powers and executive power to use force is limited to a defensive context. No, it does not have to be in defense of, quote, of a sudden attack, but it must be in defense of some vital national security interest. Here's Secretary Gates' comment on one of the Sunday talk shows in response to a question as to whether or not Libya posed an actual or imminent threat to the U.S. Gates said, no, it was not. It was not a vital national interest to the United States, but it was an interest and blah, blah, blah. I just don't think the president can wake up one morning and decide that he wants to go out and use force to use an example that David used, to acquire additional territory and what have you. So, but I will admit that David has the backing of the Somalia OLC opinion, for which there was a UN Security Council resolution. Only a general foreign policy interest and a humanitarian purpose. And the Kosovo precedent, for which there was no meaningful OLC opinion. The Kosovo use of force took place in May of 99. OLC finally got around to publishing an opinion in December of 2000. And I will come back to Peter's comment on the impact of that on the War Powers Resolution. Peter, I disagree with for at least two reasons, because as I said, I think the president needs to be defending against something that is really threatening or potentially threatening, not something that simply makes us uncomfortable to observe. You didn't you refer to the humanitarian intervention justification, and I just don't believe that there is such a domestic exception for that use of force. I also don't believe there's one from an international standpoint, and that. But again, as I say, we certainly do have the Kosovo precedent, and on the international side, the UK relied on the humanitarian intervention theory in justifying the imposition of the no-fly zone in Iraq at the end of the Gulf War in March of 91. We did not, relying instead on Security Council resolutions. And then the Brits basically came around to our position in connection with the Iraq War in 2003. And then to the extent that Peter's argument is that the congressional authorization is not required, whether as a Security Council authorization for the use of force, I just don't quite get it. I think the president might use the Security Council resolution as evidence of a vital national interest. And I think that's basically what Tim Flanagan was saying in his Somalia opinion, and that Bill Barr was saying in his little cover note to the president. But I don't think it's something that automatically says that okay, there's no congressional approval required. There's certainly no compulsion to act under the Security Council resolutions that we've seen, and even if there were, it would still have to pass constitutional muster. A Security Council resolution is neither a sufficient nor a necessary condition for not getting congressional approval. Then there's this, again, I don't want to put words in Peter's mouth, but basically I think what I'd refer to as this is not a war argument. Here's what Harold Coe said in his statement to the American Society of International Law last Saturday. Quote, the president has well-recognized authority to authorize a mission of this kind, which, as he explained, will be time-limited, well-defined, discreet, and aimed at preventing an imminent humanitarian catastrophe that directly implicates national security and foreign policy interests of the United States. Just a little footnote here is that I think there's a little bit of a difference between that statement of the interests and the Secretary Gates comment that I referred to earlier. In his OLC opinion on Haiti, Walter Dellinger said that articulated this, this is not a war theory, and says that the president was entitled to take into account the anticipated nature, scope, and duration of the planned deployment, and in particular the limited antecedent risk that U.S. forces would encounter significant armed resistance or suffer or inflict substantial casualties as a result of the deployment. And he said, indeed, it was the president's hope that the Haitian military would agree to step down before exchanges of fire occurred. And that actually happened, but I find it sort of difficult to reach a legal conclusion based on the presidential's hope, particularly this administration. Dellinger also used a sort of an interesting example of what Haiti was not. He said that the fact that it would not involve extreme use of force, as, for example, preparatory bombardment, was also relevant, which is kind of interesting in the context of the force that's actually being used right now in Libya. But anyway, my basic problem with this, quote, this is not a war argument, is how can you be sure that it's not? And as it morphs into a war, what do you do then? And then I worry about the tactical errors that officials might make in trying to keep the conflict from becoming a, quote, war. And I noted, and Harold included in his statement last Saturday, quote, the United States has not deployed ground forces into Libya and will not do so, which only brought to mind Yogi Berra's comment that it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. Now, Attorney Tsai's arguments, and I'm afraid I'm running a little bit over here, but I'll, since these are sort of rebuttal comments, maybe I'll give up some of my rebuttal time. Basically, I think Tsai is right in his conclusion, and I think the president in this context needs the congressional approval for what he's doing in Libya. But I disagree with the reasons that Tsai gives. I just think Tsai reads too much into the concept of a declaration of war. If I took a look at one of your writings, Tsai, and I believe you're saying that any initiation of hostilities, even if defensive, constitutes a declaration of war and thus requiring congressional action. And sort of in that context, I would be interested in where, with your strict reading of the Declare War Clause, you even find the ability to defend, quote, against the sudden attack. I just don't think that's what the Declare War Clause means. I don't think that's what it what constituted a declaration of war in the founders' time. There's a great, I'm going to really violate my little time limit here, but I do want to, there's in the Patrick O'Brien, in the third volume of the Patrick O'Brien Master and Commander series, Captain Aubrey has come back from a gigantic capture of a gigantic Spanish ship laden with gold from the New World, and he's counting it. This is his retirement. This is his, what's going to keep him out of debtor's prison and so forth. And he goes around to the Admiralty to hear the report and as to how much his prize is. And the First Lord says, I am bound by precedent. My legal advisors tell me that this is the appropriate decision. We are bound by admiralty law. If the prize was made before the declaration of war, the proceeds is cheat to the crown. And that's just another, I think, an example. Granted, it's in fiction, but, you know, as David said, you know, whether or not you were in a state of declared war and did find a bunch of legal things. Now, anyway, we have some pretty impressive precedents for the position. The president does not need congressional approval when defending vital national interests. Korea, and nobody really talks about the Cuban Missile Crisis, but that was a gigantic military call-up and a large deployment, which, had they been used by any standard, would have constituted a war. And there was no question about congressional approval. Anyway, most of the strategic purpose of the declaration of war has been superseded by the UN Charter. A declaration of war, other than self-defense, would be illegal. And once the Security Council has authorized the use of force, no further notice to your enemies and neutrals is necessary. And in fact, no one is a neutral. And I'll just a quick word to say that I agree very much with Peter's comment that that Kosovo certainly put the final nail in the War Powers Resolution coffin, and I think the Baker Christopher Commission gave it a very decent burial.
Thank you, Ed. I appreciate both the remarks and the pre-rebuttal. I'm going to ask our other panel members if they would also like to use a little bit of the remaining time for rebuttal before we go to other questions.
I would like, thank you, Ron. I would like to very briefly.
This is David Rifkin talking now.
Indeed, I would briefly like to respond to what Tsai said and actually was commented upon by Ed. Tsai's position basically amounts to me a rather remarkable claim, even though we start from the same factual proposition that the power to declare war. In a formal sense, was narrow, but there are lots of functional equivalents. And recognizing, of course, that if you were in a defensive war context, no declaration was necessary. What Tsai would have us believe, the framers in drafting the language of a constitution and an issue that was very important came in fairly late in the convention, after a lot of other issues were resolved, but still remarkably important. Framers acted with considerable indirectness bordering on ineptitude. So they used the word declare war, knowing full well that it meant one thing in a very technical sense, and yet there were a lot of functional equivalents. But that is what they've done. I mean, that would be enormously, in my opinion, remarkably strained reading of what has happened. But the second point, which I've not heard Tsai or anybody else comment at great length, that position that the framers really vested the power to wage war. And by the way, if I agree with Edwin, if you construe the power to declare war that broadly, I don't see any exception for repulsing sudden attacks. But so if you do it that way, if Congress really has the power to wage war, what does it do to overall conceptual scheme for executive power that the framers have reflected, embodied in the constitutional text? Because I would submit to you that there can be no other, and that's true in two respects, there can be no other enterprise, including intelligence gathering, which requires as fulsome and robust commitment to the executive as the prosecution of war. And to conceive of a notion that you need to go to Congress for an affirmative authorization at the front end, wasting days, weeks, and months, and losing the whole enterprise would just do remarkable violence to the whole concept of the executive that the framers have conceived, despite some disagreements. And by the way, it's a little bit of a straw man with respect, Tsai, to talk about commander-in-chief. You've not heard me put much reliance on the commander-in-chief language. It really is the executive and the vesting clause of Article 2 that is relevant here. And the final point, again, sort of a structural architecture of a constitution. I've not heard you rebut the proposition that Congress was meant to check the president, the executive, negatively for the appropriations power, not only true in this area, but in many other areas, and not in general as an entity that gives the president an affirmative approval. And by the way, clearly things have changed. If you ask the framers, they did not expect the president to be able to use force very much, largely because they did not believe, at least early on, that changed fairly quickly, by the way, that we're going to have a large standing army and navy. So Congress could, by working its appropriations power and other powers in Article 1, not provide the president with the kind of tools that he would need to wage war. Once those tools have been given to the president, however, the only thing left to Congress is the appropriations power. One final point. I agree with Edwin. By and large, the power to declare war has been supplanted by the existing international law and practical realities. The president needed congressional authorization the most, if you ask the framers if they're around, in order to be able to wage an offensive war, not a defensive war. Now, the only area in which I disagree with Edwin is, you know, who speaks for the president, who speaks for the executive, quite frankly, with all respect to Secretary Gates. It doesn't matter what Secretary Gates thinks about it. It doesn't particularly matter what Secretary of State thinks about it. As long as the president says that a given use of force is defensive, that is the judgment of the executive branch, and if it is totally implausible, he pays a political price for it. It is not a justiciable issue, and it's certainly not an issue in which Congress can, as a constitutional matter, overrule the president. Thank you.
So part of your response there, David, I take it, is if you don't give the president many toys, you don't have to worry about how he plays with them. I'm going to turn for a second here to Tsai. Tsai, you've had two different lines of argument here that have come at you. One is whether you're reading the phrase declaration of war correctly, and there's also the hodgepodge issue. You had raised the question of whether we have a hodgepodge of practices, and Peter was disagreeing with you on that. You want to respond to both of those?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Ron, and this is a great debate, and I'm getting pummeled by very good pugilists. With respect to this question about whether or not the president has authority to wage war after war has been declared against the United States, I can quote you President Washington's words. The Creek Indians declared war against the United States in 1793. Writing to the South Carolina governor, William Moultrie, Washington noted that he hoped to launch, quote, an offensive expedition against the refractory part of the Creek Nation. Whenever Congress should decide that such measures be necessary and proper, the Constitution vests the power of declaring war with Congress. Therefore, no offensive expedition of importance can be undertaken until after they have deliberated upon the subject and authorized such a measure. And if you look at early practice, and if you look at practice as late as World War II, presidents did not believe that they had a unilateral right to declare war once another nation had declared war against the United States, either formally or informally. So if you look at the Tripoli conflict, Jefferson went to Congress. If you look at the War of 1812, Madison's speech to Congress, he says that England is at war with the United States and the U.S. is at peace with England, and Congress has to act. And if you look at John Adams in the quasi-war with France, he takes the same position. And, of course, if you look at Roosevelt, he goes to Congress for the declaration of war. He doesn't believe he has authority to wage war immediately. I'm not claiming that the Constitution is an ideal allocation of a war power. I actually don't favor the allocation that I find within it. But I do think that's the system they set up. It's obviously not made for modern times, but much of the Constitution isn't. As far as the hodgepodge claim, what I was referring to was what Peter was referring to, both the two Iraq wars, but also the authorization to use military force against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And I understand Peter's distinction. I think Peter's distinction, if it's something narrow, then the president doesn't need to go to Congress. If it's something broader, he does. And I can see someone trying to draw that distinction, and I can see practically how the president is able to get away with so-called limited wars of limited duration because there's not enough time to gin up enough opposition to stop it because it ends much sooner than that. But I suppose that leaves open the question of what happens if you start a, quote, limited war only to find that it becomes more broad. I don't know if Peter believes that at some point you have to go back to Congress and get approval in the midst of this formally limited war. And then finally, I want to say I agree with Mr. Williamson about, I think he said this, and if he didn't, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but I believe we are at war with Libya in war and in fact.
Well, thank you, Si. Let me ask Peter. There are a couple of points that were raised in the back and forth. One, Ed had disagreed with you about the nature of the Tim Flanagan memo, what it said and what it meant. And also, would you respond to the statement that has come from a couple of people, which is that whatever the nature of the president's constitutional authority here, the existence of a UN Security Council resolution doesn't take the place of actual constitutional authority if it isn't there already?
Well, I think that's the key question, and I think that's where Ed and I disagree, is whether a UN Security Council resolution can define our, in Ed's words, vital national interests. I think we're getting precedent that says that it can, at least in the context of these limited engagements. I'm happy to have Ed put words in my mouth in saying that there is a, this is not a war kind of argument in the clear practice here. So we will get an answer here, or Libya, the Libya operation will supply a precedent, assuming that Congress doesn't rise up and get its act together and adopt a formal pronouncement to the effect that this was beyond President Obama's power here. When Sy says presidents have been getting away with these limited engagements because they're over before Congress can do anything about it, I disagree with that. Congress can, certainly through sense of resolutions, issue institutional pronouncements on this kind of constitutional question, and they don't in these cases of limited engagements, with which in my view evidences institutional acceptance of the constitutionality of the operation, which then adds to the accretion of precedent. So this, the Libya operation will become a precedent for future presidential action on the basis of UN Security Council resolutions, which in my view are sufficient to establish constitutional authority, at least in the context of limited engagements.
Let me ask another question here, and I want to Ed, to go back to you for a piece of this. One of the things that David has said that I sort of paraphrased was that the fact of the matter is that things have changed to a certain extent by the authorization by Congress over a long period of time of a very substantial standing military force for the United States. If Congress is authorizing that force, does that give us a signal that they want the president to be able to use it, at least for limited periods? Or is there nothing we can deduce from what Congress has done with respect to the size and nature of the military force?
Can I just go first, if you don't mind?
Ron, this is David, David Rifkin. I'm going to ask each of you, just to, as you intervene, just announce.
Right. This is David Rifkin. I think it's an excellent question, and it's a perfect example of a proper adaptation of a constitutional text, not a living constitution to emphasize side, but adaptation of a constitutional text to change realities. I believe that the framing generation, again, understood that the president would have a power to use unilaterally force in a defensive mode. The fact that the question posed by Ron and the answer to it, namely that Congress has created on a permanent basis substantial peacetime military establishment, underscores in the view of Congress and of American people as a whole, I think, the world has changed to the point where the threats to our national security are sufficiently grave, can come at any time, that that kind of military establishment is necessary, and it does reflect congressional recognition, but it is necessary to give a president broad, untrammeled authority to deal with a variety of such threats, so long as he designates them as defensive. And again, the question of what is defensive versus offensive in that context is really a plenary determination by the president that cannot be gainsaid either by Article III courts or by Congress.
Let me ask you, thank you, David. Let me ask you, Ed, to rejoin, if you would.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree. I think that one of the, you know, the balance that was struck in the Constitution and the role that Congress, you know, would play in a use of force through its power of the purse and has been, and its, you know, ability to fund an army, a non-standing army, has been undercut by the fact that we now have a gigantic standing defense establishment. So that's where I think that tool that Congress had has been significantly dulled. I don't think that means that therefore you need to look to the Declare War Clause to find a requirement that Congress's approval be obtained prior to using that standing army. Let me just say a couple of things in response to these comments. On the precedence of the two Gulf Wars and the post 9/11 EUMF, I get that thrown back at me constantly as evidence of the requirement that Congress give its approval to the use of force. And I think that those were very wise. I think the Bush president going to Congress was a very wise political move. But they made very clear in their signing statements that they didn't think it was required as a constitutional matter. And I mean, my experience in the Papa Bush administration at Bush 41, there was certainly, you know, I think the president would have gone ahead with the Gulf War, even had we not gotten either the UN resolution or the congressional approval. It would have been a disaster politically, but I think constitutionally, legally, he could have done that. And I agree with you, Cy, 100% that we have a war, whatever you want to call it. I mean, with what we're doing in Libya. And one sort of example that I also just mentioned is the, I mean, Congress has the, you know, does do some sort of long-term authorizations, and I'm kind of reluctant to get too, find too many implicit authorizations in the, you know, the annual defense budgets. But, you know, the disclosure that, you know, we're putting CIA, we're doing covert action in Libya, is done pursuant, is, I mean, there is congressional authorization for that. And so Congress knows how to do that, and the president knows how to work within that, within the constitutional, within his constitutional powers. I think it, so it doesn't really trigger a congressional approval issue, but I think it does go to the quantitative definition of war.
Let me ask one last question here before we take our break, and that is that I think Ed was very clear, as was Peter, that the War Powers Resolution is now dead and buried. Let me ask Cy if he agrees with that, and if so, whether it's appropriately dead and buried.
Thanks, Ron. This is Cy Prakash. The War Powers Resolution neither satisfies those who believe that the president has unilateral authority to use the military force as he sees fit, nor does it satisfy those who believe, as I do, that he needs congressional authorization to wage war. So I don't really know whether it's dead and buried. You know, some things have a way of resurfacing from time to time. It's certainly the case that presidents don't seem to be paying it much heed. You might have thought that this president would have been one president who would pay it heed, given his prior campaign statements about the president's wartime authority.
Not to mention his vice president's role. And
yes, they both have said things that are contrary to what they're doing now. So it may very well be dead and buried. I have to say, from it seems like both sides on this issue don't really believe that it reflects the Constitution properly, and so maybe it deserves an early burial or a belated burial. I'm not really too much concerned about the War Powers Act. So there you have it, Ron.
Ron, can I, if
yes.
possible, can I just pose one
David Rivkin?
Yes.
Yes.
Cy, I noticed you've not exactly answered my twofold question, which is, if this is your view of allocational war powers being the core aspect of executive power, how does it mesh with the broader scheme that is reflected in the Constitution about the nature of executive power, and particularly the way in which legislature can check the executive? And the related question, if framers really wanted to cabin the president's war-making powers, what do you say to my point that they've chosen remarkably bad draftsmanship to do so, particularly because they saw two perfectly fine pieces of language that absolutely clearly cabinet shut, the way it was done in the Articles of Confederation, and the way it was done with the United States?
Well,
you've got the last minute to answer.
I appreciate the rephrasing of the question, David. I would say the fact that Congress has a check on the spending power does not imply that there are no other checks. So I just don't draw the conclusion you do from the existence of one, that there are no others on presidential war making. As to whether or not Congress was remark, or the convention and the drafting convention, the Philadelphia Convention, was remarkably obtuse in using this language, I think you're just wrong to suggest that this language is less than clear, because no one at the founding claimed that the president had the power to wage war. Every single comment's to the contrary, and early practices to the contrary. So where you see a lack of clarity and a failure to enunciate a principle, I actually think that people well understood this at the founding.
But you agree that the Article 6 of Confederation, of Articles of Confederation, was drafted pretty tightly on this issue. And so is the language pertaining to the ability of states to wage war.
Right. Well, as I said, right, I wouldn't deny what you've just said. What I would say is that where you see a lack of clarity, others at the founding didn't see a lack of clarity. They all agreed that the president had no authority to wage war on his own, that was part of Congress's power to declare war. So the fact that something can be expressed in many ways, both of which are clear, does not make one of them unclear.
And for our listeners, the last question and answer were provided respectively by David Rifkin and Sai Prakash. Let me thank all of the participants in this, both the speakers and the audience, for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you, one and all. This concludes our podcast.